From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What do you make of these statistics? In 1990, a quarter of young black males were in jail or prison on probation or parole. The chance that a black male was in a jail or prison was seven times that of a white male. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Michael Tonry, the author of a new book about race, crime, and punishment in America. He says that our crime policies disproportionately target African Americans. Also today, the life of Jack Kerouac told in his own words. Many of his letters to friends, family, and publishers have been published for the first time. We'll talk to the editor, Ann Charters. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by the organ combo Medeski, Martin, and Wood. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The White House says President Clinton will visit Russia and meet President Boris Yeltsin this May. Mr. Clinton will be in Moscow on May 9th for ceremonies marking the end of World War II in Europe. He'll then visit Ukraine. Six people died in Tokyo today when the city's subway system was poisoned by gas. More than 3,200 people went to the hospital. Japanese authorities say the attack was deliberate and coordinated. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
There are more questions than answers in the incident that authorities say is a murder case involving the release of the nerve gas sarin, an agent developed by Germany during World War II and banned under the Geneva Convention. Packages wrapped in newspaper, discovered at various subway stations in the central part of the city, were said to be the source of the deadly fumes. Discussions about the banned substance sarin saturated the Japanese media. There has been a series of mysterious cases involving what authorities believe is sarin in Japan, but none as wide-reaching as this latest incident. Last summer, seven people died after exposure to the toxic gas in the central Japan town of Matsumoto. That case, too, remains under investigation. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
The Alabama Department of Public Safety says one person has died in the giant pileup of vehicles on the highway bridge over Mobile Bay. A spokeswoman says another 53 people have been sent to local hospitals. The whole thing started when cars ran into a giant wall of fog. They slowed down, but the cars behind them didn't and rammed into the first cars. Officials say more than 150 vehicles were involved. Russian military officials say their troops have launched an offensive against Chechen rebel strongholds south and east of Grozny, the capital of Chechnya. NPR's Anne Garrels reports from Moscow.
This appears to be the most concerted military action against the rebels since Russian forces overran Grozny earlier this year. Russian jets and artillery have been pounding the towns of Argun, Gudermes, and Shali, where Chechen separatists had their headquarters. According to Itar Tass, Russian forces now occupy nearly the whole valley south of Grozny, where not long ago Chechen forces had roamed at will. The Russians say 1,300 servicemen have been killed and 4,000 have been wounded in the three-month-old war, with another 400 reported missing. Russia's Human Rights Commission said last month as many as 24,000 civilians have been killed in Grozny alone. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
Atlanta Mayor Bill Campbell says one worker died today at the Olympic Stadium when a section under construction collapsed. Two other people were hurt. The accident occurred when some metal beams fell. They were holding up a bank of lights. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen nearly 8 points to 4,081. The Nasdaq is up almost 2 points at 810. This is NPR. The man convicted of shooting six people to death on a Long Island commuter train wants his guilty verdicts thrown out. Colin Ferguson says he didn't understand how hard it would be to act as his own lawyer during his trial and didn't have enough time to prepare his case. Ferguson is representing himself again at his sentencing hearing today. He faces 25 years to life on each of the six murder convictions. He was also convicted of 13 counts of attempted murder. The health director of Stamford, Connecticut, has temporarily closed a hair salon after he was told no one there could cut his hair. Tondalea Wilder of Connecticut Public Radio reports.
Dr. Andrew McBride says he suspects he was denied service at the Sweeney Todd Salon in Stamford because he's black. McBride says the shop's employees didn't raise the race issue, but they referred to his curly hair when they said no one could cut it. He says he took action after he saw other people receiving service.
I don't go along with this, that there's this great secret on how to deal with one group of hair versus the other. I think people have to have a willingness to learn about it and do it. And I think right now, I think it's not only here, but other places where there's not this willingness to do this, particularly for African Americans.
McBride says it will be up to state health officials to determine if its license should be suspended. For National Public Radio, I'm Tondalea Wilder in Stamford, Connecticut.
Defense Secretary William Perry is meeting with Kuwait's rulers today. They're talking about how to improve the Emirates' security force since there is new evidence that Iraq is beginning another military buildup. Perry was able to persuade Saudi Arabia on his trip to allow the U.S. access to the Saudi military bases. That deal was struck after Perry showed the Saudis military photos of the Iraqi buildup. Perry will meet with U.S. crews from the two A-10 Thunderbolt squadrons that have been in Kuwait since last year. Perry had the anti-tank teams sent there after the last Iraqi military buildup. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Who isn't worried about violent crime nowadays? Congress has been responding with legislation designed to get tough on criminals. Last year's crime bill included a 3-strikes-and-you're-out provision. The proposed Republican crime bill calls for creating tougher penalties to deter criminals. Meanwhile, the prison population nearly tripled during the 1980s. The chance that an African-American male was in a jail or prison was 7 times that of a white male. What do you make of that? My guest Michael Tonry says African Americans are being disproportionately targeted by crime policies. Tonry is the author of a new book about race and crime called Malign Neglect. He's also the general editor of the Oxford University Press series Studies in Crime and Public Policy, and he's a law professor at the University of Minnesota. Tonry told me why he's studying race and crime.
At this moment, half the people in American prisons are black. At this moment, more than half of the people being sent to American prisons are black. That enormous increase of the black presence in American prisons is the result of conscious social policies of conservative crime controllers over the last decade. That seems to me shameful, but it also seems to me seriously and deeply destructive.
Why do you think there is such a high proportion of black men in prison now?
Among researchers who do what I do for a living, black and white, conservative and liberal, with only polar exceptions, there is broad agreement that the principal reason why so many more blacks are in prisons, relatively speaking, than whites, is that blacks have much higher rates of commission of the serious kinds of crimes, like rape and homicide and aggravated assault and murder, that traditionally have placed people in American prisons.
And why is that? Why is that?
The reasons for that have been understood since W.E.B. Du Bois, a great American black intellectual of the turn of the century, wrote about it, and continuously since. Black Americans, much more than whites, live in social and economic conditions that structure what researchers or what social theorists call life chances. The life chances of American black kids, American black babies, on average, are substantially less at birth than the life chances of whites, for all the reasons that we've always known influence the choices that people make in their lives. Broken homes, low income, living in devastated neighborhoods, insufficient educations, all of those things disproportionately affect American blacks. I mean, that's the reason why these rates are so much higher.
But what you're saying is that the black crime rate hasn't really gone up since 1980. What has changed is the disproportionate punishment of blacks.
That's right. One of the surprising lessons to me when I took on this subject that academics by and large have avoided for the last 25 years because it is so controversial, is the discovery that if we go back to 1970, we would find that 42 or 43% of the people arrested for serious violent crimes were black. And it turns out that's the same percentage in 1975 and 1980 and 1985 and 1990 and 1993. I was surprised to find that because I suspected, partly on the basis of media accounts of what's happening in American cities, that violent crime rates involving blacks were getting worse, and that was at least part of the reason for why the numbers of blacks in prison have increased so much more rapidly in recent years than have the numbers of whites. So I discovered that if we want to try to understand why there are so many more blacks in prison and being sent to prison, the reason wasn't that blacks are increasingly committing the kinds of serious crimes that traditionally in American history have caused the most severe punishments to be imposed. It wasn't that at all. And so the next job that I had was to try to figure out what it was that was causing the rates at which blacks are sent to prison and the rates at which they are in prison on any given day to be increasing so rapidly.
And what conclusion did you reach?
Well, there are two primary factors. The first, and much the most important over the last 15 years, was the war on drugs that was launched by initially the Reagan and then followed up by the Bush administrations, which, for a whole variety of reasons having nothing to do with racial patterns of who uses drugs and little or nothing to do with racial patterns of who sells drugs or who makes money from drugs, but did have the effect of greatly increasing the number of young minority males in the inner cities who were arrested for drug trafficking and sent to prison for very long terms. That's the single most important cause of the enormous increases in black punishment in this country.
Drug offense sentences are the single most important cause of the tripling of the prison population since 1980, yes?
Accurate statistic? That's true. Yes, ma'am.
And you're saying that the war on drugs is one of the primary reasons why the African-American male prison population has grown in the numbers that it has. So what's the correlation between the war on drugs and the growing African-American male prison population?
Well, that correlation is clear. One way to express that is to look at the likelihood that black Americans and white Americans will be arrested for drug trafficking offenses. Throughout the 1980s, the rate at which white Americans were arrested for drug crimes was absolutely flat. I mean, only a statistician cares about the details, but the number was 300 per 100,000 whites were arrested for drug crimes on average every year for that 10-year period. In 1980, about 500 blacks per 100,000 were arrested for drug crimes, but by 1989, that had risen to 1,700. The white rate had remained stable. The black rate had tripled by a factor of three until it was five times higher than the arrest rate for whites for drug crimes. Now, that's the single most, and the sentences that federal sentencing policy and states that followed them have required for drug crimes have gotten longer and longer as the years have passed. That's the single most important reason why so many more blacks are caught up in the arms of the law today than was true 15 years ago or than was true 5 years ago. A logical next question is, but wasn't it necessary to achieve the purposes of the war on drugs to increase the rates at which people were arrested for drug crimes? And a corollary to that is, and if blacks were selling drugs more often than whites, then shouldn't we expect that arrest rates for blacks would be higher than that? The answer to the two questions that I just posed for myself are these. No informed drug policy expert, and I include both academics and senior federal officials, believed by the mid-1980s that massive levels of street arrests of drug dealers was going to have any significant effect on either the volume of drug use or the volume of drug crime or the prices of drugs as they are sold on the street. But despite that, the principal strategic approach that I think for ideological reasons that the Reagan and Bush administrations chose to pursue the drug war was street-level drug enforcement. Now, what drug policy experts in other countries would have told them, and what was well known at the time, was that dollar for dollar and more importantly, much more likely to have an effect on drug use, was investment in drug treatment and drug education. Had we been serious as a policy matter about affecting drug use and drug crime in the United States, we would have invested in treatment and in education, not in massive street arrests, especially when we know now, and we knew then, that the enemy soldiers, as it were, in the war on drugs were going to be young minority males in the devastated inner city areas where drug trafficking is visible and where it's easy for policemen to make what is called a buy, to appear offering to purchase drugs and find somebody willing to sell them.
So let me see if I understand you. You're saying the war on drugs meant that a lot of young African-American inner-city males ended up behind bars for using or selling drugs. And if they were using or selling drugs, shouldn't they have been behind bars?
Well, that's a hard question. I mean, I think it's not a hard question. Some of them should have been, of course. I mean, people whose real crimes are crimes of violence and are simply involved in drug trafficking, sure, prison is an entirely appropriate response for crimes of violence. As to the more general question, though, of whether it was justifiable to adopt a national drug policy that foreseeably was going grossly disproportionately to affect young black males, the answer is no, for two reasons. First reason is we knew full well that massive arrests of street-level drug dealers in the inner cities was not going to reduce the volume of drug trafficking in America. The reality of the choices available to young disadvantaged men in American cities are such that drug policy experts and cops will tell you now and would have told you 10 years ago that for every young dealer arrested on a street corner, there will be a replacement available within 2 or 3 days. The economic opportunities were just so attractive relative to the other opportunities people had available that we knew that we weren't going to affect the drug trade or the volume of drug use by wholesale arrests of young blacks. So as a matter of cause and effect, there was no cause and effect argument that could be made. So it was a futile policy. But more importantly, it was a policy which was foreseeably going to have an effect, which it did have, which was to worsen the conditions of life in the black community and in the families of those young black men, their parental families and the women with whom they were associated and the children whom they sired. Life became harder.
Michael Tonry is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Malign Neglect, Race, Crime, and Punishment in America. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Tonry, and he's the author of the new book, Malign Neglect, Race, Crime, and Punishment in America. There's a movement now in America toward stricter sentencing. For instance, the Contract with America and its crime bill calls for mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes. What do you think of that?
It's a bad idea. It's a bad idea now. It's been a bad idea for the last 15 years when many states have had mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes and the federal government has had mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes. Why is it a bad idea? Because we know and have long known that mandatory minimum penalties have virtually no effects on drug use or drug trafficking or crime rates when they're applied to other crimes. They're ineffective, but they're cruel. And so if the goal is to reduce drug use or drug trafficking, they won't do that. We also know that they're unnecessary. Offenders who've committed serious crimes, including serious greedy or violent drug trafficking crimes, receive prison sentences whether they're mandatory minimums or not. I mean, judges and prosecutors are in the business of imposing what they see as deserved penalties. In cases where judges and prosecutors don't think people deserve the kind of harsh penalty that mandatory minimums often require, they do one of two things. They evade the mandatory minimum penalty, or they impose it and hold their noses, knowing that they're violating their oath to do justice, but they're following the law. So mandatory minimums are bad public policy for drug crimes and for anything else.
What do you think of three strikes and you're out?
Three strikes policies are bad policies. They suffer the same problem that mandatory minimum laws do, which is that we have no evidence at all that they have any effects on crime rates. They have no known deterrent effects on behavior. but they're bad public policy for other reasons. They sometimes capture small fry, like the Californian and like the man in California this fall who's going to prison for the rest of his life because he stole some pizza from some children in a schoolyard, it being his third felony. But they're also enormously wasteful and expensive. The estimates in California are that California is going to spend $240 additional billion dollars by the year 2030 because of its three strikes law. And it's not going to accomplish the public goods that are wanted. It's not going to deter crime first. But more importantly, it's going to hold people in prison long past the points in their lives when they represent any sort of a social threat. The other rationale for punishment besides deterrence, ordinarily, is what's called incapacitation, locking people up so they can't be predators. But we know that violence is highly skewed toward the young years of people's lives. Very few people who are violent even when they're in their 20s remain violent in their mid-30s and certainly not in their 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s. So it's an enormous waste of public resources and often unnecessarily cruel.
You've come up with some suggestions about how to ease the damaging social effects of crime control policies in America. And one of your suggestions is that judges should have the power to mitigate sentences to take into account an individual's background and circumstances. Why should a judge take into account an offender's background? And how should they take that into account?
What's interesting to me is that you would ask that question phrased in that way because it would have been common ground in the United States until 1980, and it remains common ground in every other Western country, that judges in setting sentences look at the seriousness of the crime and they look at the circumstances and background of the offender to decide both what is a just punishment for that offender for that crime and what's an appropriate punishment in terms of reducing the likelihood that that offender is going to appear in court again. The idea of what is called individualizing punishments is not a radical idea. It's only a radical idea in a framework in which the Contract for America is used as a base for thinking about what the options ought to be.
Well, a lot of people would say, well, isn't it a lot more fair to say that no matter who committed the crime gets this particular sentence, period. And everybody's treated the same. A lot of people say that would be the more fair way of doing it.
I think in the abstract, if you called someone up at 7 o'clock at night as part of a Gallup poll survey and asked them that question, they would give the answer that you just suggested. But when you deal with real living human beings, my experience is that certainly that criminal justice officials, judges and prosecutors and probation officers and defense lawyers, but more importantly, ordinary people do want to make distinctions. Take theft, for example. People want to distinguish between a person stealing food or stealing money because there's absolute want in the household to feed a starving child, to take a soppy melodramatic kind of case, between a defendant and an offender who's drug dependent and is stealing money to pay for a drug habit, a defendant who is a professional thief and steals money as a way of earning a living, a defendant who steals purely out of caprice. Most people want to make those kinds of moral distinctions. It isn't simply offenses that lead to most decisions about what's just, but it's the circumstances in which offenses take place, the motives of the people who commit them, the background of the person who did it.
Your new book, Malign Neglect, is about race, crime, and punishment. And as you've pointed out, there is a very high percentage of young African-American men who have prison records now. That leads a lot of people to conclude, well, that's because young black men are more violent or more prone to using drugs, therefore they're more dangerous. And I think that prison record has had the effect of increasing the amount of fear people have about young black men. What would you say about that?
Well, that's an unintended side effect that I hadn't ever expressed in those terms. If it is true, as I've said earlier in this conversation, that American drug policies have given many more young minority males criminal records and prison records than was necessary, your proposition that having a criminal record makes people look even more dangerous and makes the public even more likely to want to be severe and harsh is another dimension to it. I agree with the point that you make.
Are you often asked if you've ever been a victim?
Yes.
And have you? And is that relevant? Should that be relevant to our opinion about your views on crime and punishment?
Well, I've been asked the question, and the answer is I've been burglarized a half dozen times, and once was the victim of a fairly violent street mugging on 52nd Street in New York City. So the answer is yes, I've been a victim of crime and of violent crime. As to whether that should matter to how either what I think or what people think about what I think the answer is no. The justice system is about justice. The social welfare system is about the welfare of Americans, and that too is about justice, not criminal justice, but social justice. And I don't think the question of who's been victimized is especially important to it. In the U.S., in the 1990s and in the 1980s, there has been a misperception that life is becoming more dangerous for most people most of the time. I take it almost implicit in your question is a proposition, well, but crime has been getting worse and the public is frightened by it and concerned by it, and so politicians have to do something about it. It's just not true. I won't cite all the statistical and social science evidence that suggests it's not true. For the vast majority of Americans, the 90-95% who do not live in devastated inner city areas, the chances of victimization, especially violent victimization, have steadily decreased for 20 years, long before the current get tough on crime policies were adopted. The chances that people who are unfortunate enough to live, the 3 or 4 or 5% of people in the worst, most devastated inner city areas will be victims of violent crime, have increased substantially. So that there's a maldistribution of crime, but overall, life is not getting more dangerous for Americans. And how that affects, I mean, whether I've been a victim, I don't know.
Well, that seems all really counterintuitive when you think of the number of guns in the streets now. But you know the old cliche that a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged?
Well, I'm a liberal. I'm a liberal who's been mugged, and I'm not conservative.
So after you were mugged, did you want to make sure that that person stayed behind bars a long time? Or would you have been particularly angry if you found out that this was somebody's, like, third mugging? And they kept getting put into jail, and they're out again, and they got you the third time they were out.
I'm not sure I'd be especially interested in that kind of rationalization. Violent crimes, it seems to me, not inappropriately often result in prison sentences. Now, they don't need to result in 5 and 10 and 20-year prison sentences, as is typically the case in the U.S., but I would have no problem if the person who mugged me, who was never caught, to my knowledge, had gone to jail for 60 days or 90 days. I would object if they'd gone to jail for 5 years or 10 years, but I think that's cruel and useless.
Michael Tonry, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Michael Tonry is the author of the new book Malign Neglect, Race, Crime, and Punishment in America. He's a professor at the University of Minnesota. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jack Kerouac's celebrated novel, On the Road, is being made into a movie. Now we can read about Kerouac's personal experiences on the road through his letters to friends and family, which have been published for the first time. Coming up, we talk with the editor of his collected letters, Ann Charters. She also wrote the first biography of Kerouac. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by the organ combo Medeski, Martin, and Wood. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has talked to British Prime Minister John Major in an effort to smooth over tension. This was created when President Clinton invited the president of Sinn Féin, Gerry Adams, to the White House. Sinn Féin is linked to the Irish Republican Army. UPI's Carol Van Dam prepared this report.
In his 25-minute phone call to Major, Mr. Clinton promised to discuss decommissioning IRA weapons with Adams. The president further distanced himself from the British government by inviting Adams to a St. Patrick's Day reception at the White House last week. White House Press Secretary Mike McCurry describes the relationship between the president and Major as warm and cordial. British officials describe yesterday's conversation as businesslike. Adams says British authorities, loyalists, and the IRA in Northern Ireland should all disarm to advance the peace process. Carol Van Dam, The White House.
Authorities in Mobile, Alabama say one person has died in the massive pileup on Interstate 10. The big crash occurred on the bridge over Mobile Bay. At least 53 people have been hospitalized. Officials say more than 100 cars and trucks collided in fog during the morning rush hour. Witnesses say the incident began with one accident. They report as other cars slowed down, they were hit from behind, leading to a string of pileups and burning wreckage that stretched nearly a mile. Several thousand Kurdish troops crossed into northern Iraq today to fight Kurdish guerrillas opposing the Turkish government. Turkey says the aim of the mission is to destroy bases of the separatist Kurdistan Workers Party, or the PKK. The BBC's Claire Poynton filed this report.
Turkish officials say 14 aircraft dropped more than 70 bombs on points in the north and northeast of the region today during 33 sorties. There are no details of casualties. In what government spokesman Yıldırım Aktuna described as the biggest military operation mounted by Turkey, the authorities say they'll be pushing 40 kilometers inside Iraq to attack four areas where they say more than 2,500 PKK fighters are sheltering. The Prime Minister, Tansu Çiller, described the operation as one of hot pursuit. She said its aim was to clean up the area and cut the routes of PKK attacks inside Turkey. However, the Kurdistan Democratic Party, which controls the western part of the region, has condemned the incursion as unjustified. It said the places being targeted were inhabited by Iraqi Kurdish civilians.
Claire Poynton reporting. The United States has condemned the nerve gas attack on the Tokyo subway system today as senseless. The Japanese government is treating the incident as a terror attack. Six people died when a chemical was released into the subway system, and at least 3,200 people were hospitalized. The United States has offered Japan technical assistance. Yet another record today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 10 points to end the day at 4,083. Advances and declines were about even in active trading. This is NPR News. Heavy fighting has broken out in Tuzla, Bosnia. There are unconfirmed reports of dozens of people dead and more wounded. Rebel Serbs reportedly attacked the city in retaliation for a government offensive on a strategic mountain nearby. There are several other fronts in Bosnia. Shells were heard near the Bosnian government town of Travnik today, and at least six people were hurt in Sarajevo by sniper fire. A shaky truce expires May 1st. Both the Bosnian government and the Serbs have indicated they won't renew it. Israeli soldiers are enforcing an around-the-clock curfew in the West Bank town of Hebron. Two Jewish settlers died in a bus attack yesterday. Five others were hurt. A radical Muslim group has claimed responsibility. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
An anonymous caller to the Associated Press News Service in Lebanon said the Hebron wing of a group called the Jerusalem Guards was responsible for last night's attack. The group is believed linked to the radical Palestinian groups of Hamas and Islamic Jihad. But the Israeli police minister said the attack was done by a local cell of Hamas led by two Palestinians from Hebron, and he was confident they would be arrested. A curfew remained in place in Hebron, and Israeli soldiers braced for possible violence during the funerals later today. The victims from the nearby settlement of Kiryat Arba will be buried in the Jewish cemetery in Hebron, a town where a few hundred Jews live among 100,000 Palestinians. Jewish settlers say they will launch an all-out effort to bring down the Israeli government. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
A published report says the government is investigating whether the big three automakers charged higher interest rates on car loans for minority customers than for white customers. The Detroit News says the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission are checking lending practices of the credit arms of Ford, Chrysler, and GM. Federal law prohibits lenders from rejecting loans or charging higher interest rates on the basis of race. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a revival of interest in the late Jack Kerouac, the most celebrated of the beat writers. A movie adaptation of his novel On the Road is in the works. Gap's Khaki campaign has capitalized on his image as beat icon. And Rhino Records recently brought out a box set of Kerouac's readings. Kerouac called his books true story novels. Now we can read the true stories behind the fiction. His letters to friends, family, and publishers from 1940 to 1956 are collected for the first time in a new book edited by Anne Charters. She also edited a new anthology of his writing called The Portable Jack Kerouac. Charters wrote the first biography of Kerouac. Before she reads some of his letters, I want you to hear Kerouac's voice. Here he is in 1959 on the Steve Allen Show, reading from and talking about On the Road with Steve Allen at the piano.
Well, a lot of people have asked me why did I write that book or any book. All the stories I wrote were true because I believed in what I saw. I was traveling west one time at the junction of the state line of Colorado, its arid western one, in the state line of poor Utah. I saw in the clouds, huge and massed above the fiery golden desert of Evenfall, the great image of God with forefinger pointed straight at me through halos and rolls and gold folds that were like the existence of a gleaming spear in his right hand.
Anne Charters' new book marks the first time that Kerouac's estate has allowed his letters to be published. But Anne Charters first read many of Kerouac's letters back in 1966 when Kerouac invited her to help prepare a bibliography of his writing. He had kept carbon copies of all of his letters. I asked her why.
Because he used his letters. Kerouac really felt that he was in need of his own personal archive of his own life because he used his life as the basis of, for his writing, for his books. So he would go back to a carbon, say, of a letter that he'd written John Cullen Holmes describing an incredible ride in a car with a blonde in the fall of 1955. And 3 years later, he'd go back to that and he'd use it as part of a novel in progress, which was The Dharma Bums.
You write that the letters bring us closer to the life Kerouac actually lived before turning it into literature. How do you find his life as described through his letters compares to what he describes in his novels?
Well, there's one very significant addition in his letters. I mean, on the one hand, he will use similar material like the ride with the good blonde that he put into The Dharma Bums and then made into an article a short story later. But on the other hand, what he doesn't put into any of his books is that he spends all his time being a writer. And the letters are filled with descriptions of his life as a writer, which is the truest life he ever lived.
Kerouac's best-known book is probably On the Road. Do you have a favorite letter that Kerouac wrote to a friend while on the road?
Well, I love the one to John Cullen Holmes, who was a great, great friend of Kerouac's. He wrote John Cullen Holmes, Kerouac, from San Francisco. And this was October 12th, 1952. And it was after Kerouac, about a year after Kerouac had discovered his writing method of spontaneous prose and had decided to only write this very, very extraordinary way so that he couldn't really find a publisher that easily who would accept this remarkable new way of writing. And so he wrote John after a year of this without any money, no income at all. Publishers had published a first novel and they turned down the manuscript of On the Road, which he'd written 6 months before. Dear John, here I sit in my little room in Frisco, Skid Row, the first time in weeks I've had to sit and write in response to your letter and check. Holmes sent him the money to get to San Francisco. He didn't have any. I just came in from work. We'll be going out again in 8 hours. That's work on the railroad. Work sometimes 24 hours a day. Have no time whatever for anything but sleep. I get in my double bed with Bop on the radio, a poor boy, half bottle of Tokay wine, the shades drawn, and I try to rest and think. Some lost song is beating in my soul that I have not sung and cannot sing. The star of my sister. I remember her pale little face in holy snows of Lowell. Now, like all America, she's grown cold-hearted, blank, money-anxious. My mother angrily retorted in a letter to me, "So you want to roam and leave? Well, don't you dare do anything that will dishonor your father's name." The days of the town and the city, his first novel, are all forgotten. I start west in the rain. John, you think I'm a self-made martyr? I go 3,000 miles, sleep on a railroad porch, in Salvation flops, eat out of cans. In Hickey, North Carolina, I stand in the drizzle, exhausted. No one saves me. I stay at Ed White's in Beverly's backyard. We cook weenies, drink Tokay. I make love to big Swedish student girl Edeltrude. Mrs. White motherly packs me lunch. I hitchhike to Salt Lake City after a day spent sketching Neil's entire Denver area. Sleep in motel garage. Hitch straight to Neil's door, wild trips, including Australian history professor anxiously from top of oil pole in Nevada desert, scanning horizon for swimming hole. Nothing I like better than swimming, you know?
So how do you think the style of his writing in that letter compares to the style of writing in his novels?
It's the best Kerouac there is, the letters. It's the same as when he's really going in his novels, because his whole aim as a novelist was to have the spontaneity of the letters. But there's more to it than that. That sounds, you know, like Truman Capote saying he was only typing, not writing. What makes the novels different and truly extraordinary works of literature? These are wonderful letters, all right? He's a great letter writer. But the novels really have the advantage also of, besides this flexible, muscular, energetic prose, they also have a conception of what his life is going to be like as a novel. He takes his own life as the material for the true story novel, but he exaggerates, he weaves anecdotes in, he develops, he gives you a sense, he shows, not tells. The letters are often telling. In other words, he works as a novelist with the materials of his own life in a way no writer, American or otherwise, has ever done.
One of the letters that you reprint that I like most is about him being home and lonely.
Mm-hmm.
It was written to Neil Cassady in June of 1948, and it's about being alone at home. Would you read us an excerpt of it?
Yeah. When Jack found himself suddenly alone with his mother gone to visit his sister and Neil far away 3,000 miles in California, he sat down at his typewriter and said, "Dear Neil, I'll describe my feeling tonight, alone in the house. To be alone in a house of home is the last unhappiness. I think of it. The house is empty. It broods. It's haunted. All those things. So I start cooking big meals, curry with rice, just so I can fill the house with the odors of food and consequence. And alone, I sniff the air and think. Neil, what I want is a big home with about 20 people in it. Whole families at the same time, something going on all the time, someone leaving, someone coming, someone building a shelf, someone mending a fence, someone sewing, someone cooking, someone reading, someone eating, so on and on and on. I want all the Shakespearean gamut of things in one big, tumultuous house. I don't want to be alone in a garret, and I don't want to be an artiste. I truly know how to live, I think, and that's the way it must be. And in your saying you want a home to go and come in, to grow old in, to make into a great place, etc., you express part of my own similar feeling. It's so wonderful to know you, Neil, really."
Does that hold up? Is that consistent with other ways that Kerouac expressed what he really wanted out of life? Did he want a big house with a lot of people in it?
Yes, this is the essential Kerouac. I would say this, judging from my knowledge of him, the 2 days I spent with him in his lonely home in Hyannis with his mother, this is, it sounds crazy. We think of him as the archetypal wanderer on the road, and he was. He, as I read before from one of the letters, he was on the road often, But what he wanted, paradoxically, was this dream of a house filled with people, what he calls this Shakespearean gamut of things, which comes out of family life.
Now, why wasn't he able to get that?
Because he felt that the most important thing for him to do was write, and he couldn't support a Shakespearean gamut of a house if he was writing the kind of books he wanted to write. And those were the most important thing in his life. So he sacrificed everything for the books.
My guest is Ann Charters. She's edited a new collection of Jack Kerouac's letters from 1940 to 1956. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ann Charters, editor of a collection of Jack Kerouac's letters. In May of 1952, after Kerouac had already written On the Road, it wasn't published yet, he sent a copy of the manuscript to Allen Ginsberg, and he urged Ginsberg to read the book, complaining that no one else, none of his other friends, had had the time to read it all the way through yet. And then in June, Kerouac got a letter back from Ginsberg, and Ginsberg warned him, no one's going to want to publish this book. And Ginsberg didn't seem to be all that enthusiastic about it himself. Would you read us a short excerpt of that? I was really interested in reading Ginsberg's impressions that first time around.
It's a pretty extraordinary letter. Dear Jack, all right, the manuscript arrived a few days ago on the road. Carl read it, I read it once, and Holmes has it. I don't see how it will ever be published. It's so personal. It's so full of sex language, so full of our local mythological references. I don't know if it would make any sense to any publisher. By make sense, I mean if he could follow what happened to what characters where. The language is great. The blowing is mostly great. The inventions have full-blown ecstatic style. Also, the tone of speech is at times nearer to uninnocent heart speech, like, why did I write this, and I'm a criminal. Where you are writing steadily and well, the sketches, the exposition, it's the best that's written in America, I do believe. But I'm not stopping now to write you a praise letter, though maybe I should, etc. But in my mind, I am worried by the whole book. It's crazy, not merely inspired crazy, but unrelated crazy. Well, you know your book. Wynn, I'm positive, won't take it now. I don't know who will. I think it could be published by New Story people in Europe, but will you be revising it at all? What you trying to put down, man? You know what you done.
Did Kerouac revise On the Road after reading Ginsberg's critique?
No, he revised On the Road before reading Ginsberg's critique. Kerouac revised the first version of On the Road, written in 1951, which is the version we call On the Road. 6 months later, he started rewriting it a different way, a vertical portrayal of Neil Cassady rather than the horizontal one that he had done the first time round with On the Road. And it was this second version, the vertical, spontaneous prose, crazy version that we know as Visions of Cody, that he had sent Ginsberg. So Ginsberg's response is to Visions of Cody in 1952. Of course, the book wasn't published for another 20 years. Jack had to die before it got published in its full extent. And in the publication 20 years later, Ginsberg totally revises his opinion of the book and calls it a great masterpiece.
Was Kerouac insulted by Ginsberg's critique of the book?
He was more than insulted. He was wounded. He wrote back a letter to Ginsberg that was so angry that I'd rather not read it, actually. Let someone buy the book or get the book, read the book in the library and find it out. No, it took several weeks for the quarrel to heal. But it did because, hey, you know, they were great friends. And everyone's entitled to, you know, not like something if you ask to read it.
I think the popular image of Jack Kerouac is as the hipster who was on the road leading an exciting life and who was always like the center of attention. And I think it's possible that some of his readers even confused Kerouac with the character of Dean Moriarty in the novel On the Road, and that character was actually based on Neil Cassidy, not on Kerouac. Do you think that there is a popular misconception of who Kerouac was as a man, and a confusion between who he was and who that character of Dean Moriarty was?
Absolutely. When On the Road was published, people reading it, reviewing it, and getting excited about it really focused on the character of Dean Moriarty, who was based on one of Kerouac's friends, the young man named Neil Cassidy from Denver, Colorado, whom Kerouac had met in 1946. His brilliant breakthrough in that wasn't merely the depiction of Dean Moriarty as Neil Cassidy, it was also the discovery of Sal Paradise, the person who was himself, who he found a way to write about in a way that was not the Kerouac that is in the letters. It's a novel, it's a persona. And he didn't find that persona until he wrote the April 1951 version of Road. And that's what really freed him to think of his own life as being subject to make into novels, as legends. Yeah, but then, of course, he wrote such a brilliant book with On the Road that everyone reading it wanted him to be the wild one. And the real Jack, who was the writer Jack, kept insisting he was there, and nobody really wanted to see it.
But Kerouac wasn't that wild person.
No, he wasn't. He was the writer, I think, who was the letters. There was wildness in Kerouac, of course, or he couldn't have gone on the road with Neil Cassidy, and he couldn't have thrown himself off the cliff in his attempt to write and his achievement in writing spontaneous prose and true story novels based on his own life, and also drinking far too much and taking, you know, being strung out. He really wanted the joy of the mind rather than everyday existence. I think that's part of his being a writer and his commitment to the writing process. So there was craziness, but the difference between the two of them, Cassidy and Kerouac, was that Kerouac was essentially a writer.
Ann Charters, she's the editor of Jack Kerouac's Selected Letters, 1940 to 1956. She also edited a new anthology of his writing called The Portable Jack Kerouac. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have on the subway gas attack in Japan?
Hi, Terry. Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo. It was nerve gas. 6 people were killed. More than 1,000 were injured. The White House has condemned the attack as senseless. NPR's Dan Charles reports on sarin gas, the kind supposedly used in the attack. Also, NPR's Jackie Lighton reports on the Islamic Revolution in Iran 16 years afterwards, as the Iranian people are demanding more say in their future. British guitarist and American radio commentator Adrian Legg reports in from New Mexico, and I'll be talking with Dennis Covington, author of a new book about snake handling in churches in southern Appalachia.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When the trio Medeski, Martin, and Wood came together 3 years ago, John Medeski was the band's pianist. But when he grew frustrated with the substandard pianos he had to deal with in nightclubs, Medeski began touring with an electric organ, and the band was reborn as a jazz organ combo. Jazz critic Evan Whitehead has a review of their new CD.
A jazz critic I know went ballistic when he heard Medeski, Martin, and Wood at a festival last summer. He didn't like the fact that these vaguely hippie-ish looking white guys had appropriated the classic soul jazz vehicle, the organ combo. They don't even understand what they're ripping off, the critic said. The organ player doesn't even play bass with his feet. Now, it's true that John Medeski won't make you forget great jazz organists like Jimmy Smith or Shirley Scott, who do play slick bass lines on foot pedals. But my friend was missing something. Chris Wood, who plays upright bass, does a lot of stuff you can't do with pedals, like sliding from one note to another, leaping across several octaves, and thumping hard on the strings. That's from Medeski Martin and Wood's new album, Friday Afternoon in the Universe, which is on the Gramavision label. Billy Martin is the drummer laying down the hot funk licks. Some of those licks are lifted straight off Miles Davis's electric records of the 1970s, a conspicuous source for much of this music. One foot pedal John Medeski does use, with his organ and clavinet and electric piano, is that beloved 70s relic, the wah-wah. Miles used one a lot back then. This is from We're So Happy. That excerpt pinpoints the strength and weakness of Medeski Martin and Wood's new CD. It's got a killer groove, but not a whole lot of melodic content. Despite one or two change-ups, the music tends toward long, hypnotic jams. Not that that's bad. Sun Ra used to go in for that, too. Come to think of it, he's somebody else the trio sound like once in a while. If this album's charms lie close to the surface, that doesn't make those charms any less real. You may not want to listen to it 1,000 times, but that's all right. Like movies and books and jokes and food, jazz doesn't have to be heavy to be good.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Coda, Pulse, and The Village Voice. He reviewed Friday Afternoon in the Universe by the trio Medeski, Martin, and Wood. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Kathy Wolf, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Our interns are Sienna Chrisman and Zeb Esselstyn. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional funding is provided by Living Language. Learn a new language at home or on the go with Living Language. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This week, the House debates a Republican bill to overhaul the welfare system. Part of the debate is about benefits to unwed teenage mothers. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Judith Music, author of Young, Poor, and Pregnant, The Psychology of Teenage Motherhood. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.